You're listening to episode 251 of TV's Top 5, The Hollywood Reporter's TV podcast. I'm Leslie Goldberg, the West Coast TV editor, and I'm joined as always by the one and only Mr. Daniel Feinberg, The Hollywood Reporter's chief TV critic. How's it going, my friend?
It goes well. How are you doing, Leslie?
I'm good. It's Oscars week, so it's been a little bit slow on the TV news front. You know, that's usually what happens ahead of the Oscars, but we also had a verdict in the Rust trial. It's been a weird week.
A little bit, but we are also heading towards springing forward this weekend, which makes me happy. I am
so happy.
Very much looking forward to having my evening walk take place largely in, if not daylight, in dusk. That will make it somewhat less likely that bad Los Angeles drivers will attempt to hit me with their cars. So, no, I'm pleased with that. Or will be able to hit me with their cars or whatever it is. I try to wear very light and somewhat reflective stuff when I'm out on my walk, but I still feel much happier when I can do it in the daylight. So that's good. Yes. So as you say, definitely a slightly slow TV news week. And maybe that means that this is going to be a somewhat quick installment of the TV's Top 5 podcast. We had a couple irons in the fire for various interviews that didn't come together. And so that makes things a little bit tighter and lack of major news. So we're going to see how quick this goes. We understand that sometimes people have long commutes and they really enjoy a good 100-minute or 2-hour podcast, and that other people are perfectly happy to just have us babbling for 30 to 45 minutes. And so we're going to go closer to the latter this week, maybe.
I'll believe it when I see it, Dan.
As will everybody.
But yeah, daylight savings, very excited. That just means baseball season and summer just around the corner. So I'm very excited about that too. Just wanted to let my official position on that be known in case anyone thought otherwise. Not that anyone would think of it. Anyway, I'm rambling and let's keep it in a tight 40. So on to headlines.
Number one.
Starting off on the renewal front, Amazon has picked up its Greg Daniels sci-fi comedy Upload, one of my favorites, for a fourth and final season. Netflix has handed out a 2-season renewal for its live-action take on Avatar, The Last Airbender. The series will conclude with its 3rd season. That's a story I hadn't seen. Renewed for 2 more seasons and ending. So, that's interesting. Especially ending with 3. But anyway, there's a reason for that, obviously. It mirrors the IP that it's based on. So, and wrapping up with renewals, CBS has picked up a 2nd season of the Justin Hartley drama Tracker after strong early ratings, including the post-Super Bowl berth. TV's best time slot.
I would say that those various renewals all make various amounts of sense. I've seen some people who seem to have been enjoying Avatar The Last Airbender, the live action series, more than a lot of critics did. And so that's fine. It's appropriate. And definitely Tracker, there was never any question. I don't think that it was a show that was pretty well suited for the CBS audience and for what TV audiences are looking for.
Yeah. And I mean, I heard it to celebrate, Justin Hartley's just going to film a whole bunch of shirtless scenes, Dan.
And some days when he's feeling depressed or sad, I assume he celebrates by doing a lot of topless, shirtless scenes. I suspect that's probably how he treats both the highs and lows in life. And good for him. If I had his abs, I would probably do this podcast topless and let everybody be rest assured that I am wearing multiple layers, including a hoodie, because I am not, in fact, Justin Hartley. And I just broke Leslie with the prospect of Dan recording topless podcasts. So, oh well. Look, nobody wants this, is all I'm saying, is that CBS knows what the people want, and TV's Top 5 also knows what the people want, and that is Dan in a hoodie. So, anywho, speaking of CBS and knowing what people want, the people want Justin Hartley topless, and they want spinoffs from The Big Bang Theory. The network has officially ordered a Young Sheldon spinoff featuring Emily Osment and Montana Jordan, and focusing on their characters Mandy and Georgie. It doesn't have a name, but might I suggest Mandy and Georgie seems like a perfectly suitable name for a TV show. Or alternatively, Young Sheldon's brother and sister-in-law. That would be a really catchy name for a TV show.
Yeah, it rolls right off the tongue, just like, you know, Justin Hartley topless.
Okay, see, that just got salacious. This is not a family podcast, but it's definitely a PG-13 podcast, I think. So, which means that we are entitled to exactly one fuck in a non-sexual sense every week. So there it was.
I think you just spent it, Dan.
Totally did. Well worth it.
Moving on to castings, and speaking of young Sheldon, Jim Parsons and Maya Bialik will reunite on screen in the May series finale of the Big Bang Theory prequel. Parsons, who obviously provides narration for the show and is an executive producer, Bialik has done two voiceover gigs on the show before, but this is the first time that the former on-screen couple will appear on screen together since the May 2019 series finale of the Big Bang Theory, so bazinga. And speaking of prequels, CBS's NCIS prequel following a young version of Mark Harmon's Jethro Gibbs has found its lead in Austin Stoll. Congratulations, Austin. That show will run forever.
And if memory serves, Austin Stoll was previously cast as the young Jeff Bridges in FX's Old Man and then was recast in that role. So that's a very successful and lucrative sideline, is being young versions of famous older people. So good for him. Continuing along, Hulu has handed out an 8-episode series order for an untitled limited series about Amanda Knox, with Margaret Qualley set to star and Monica Lewinsky among the executive producers. So who said that the limited series marketplace was no longer bustling?
And this just in, MTV Entertainment Studios is developing a scripted limited series based on JonBenet Ramsey. A network or platform is not yet attached, but yeah, true crime, not going anywhere. Limited series based on true crime, also not going anywhere.
And television and movies' ghoulish obsession with JonBenet Ramsey, also not going anywhere.
Yeah, yuck. Elsewhere, former Last Man Standing star Tim Allen is returning to ABC and will star in a multi-camera comedy pilot called Shifting Gears for the Disney-owned network. It's ABC's first pilot order of the season and only the fourth overall on broadcast. We've talked about this a few times, but NBC is the only other broadcast network doing pilots this year. It's crazy. Crazy.
Definitely not the way it used to be. Continuing along with other development news, CBS is readying The Gates, which would be the first Black daytime soap opera in 35 years.
Yeah, it's a co-production with the NAACP, as well as Procter & Gamble Studios. So we'll see what happens there. But, you know, I think the last time anyone launched a new soap opera was decades ago. And obviously, everyone remembers what happened when ABC got out of the soap business and another smaller company tried to revive them and have them air online. Well, it turns out those guys were ahead of their time, because Days of Our Lives, exclusively on Peacock, still crushing. On the unscripted front, Dick Wolf has set a pair of true crime documentaries at Netflix, with Homicide New York launching March 20th and Homicide Los Angeles bowing later this year. Both of those shows fall outside of Dick Wolf's overall deal with Universal Television. And I gotta say it, why would anyone at NBC Universal let Dick Wolf take anything outside of the company, especially to Netflix? That's just stupid. Like, especially with what works on Peacock, these are prime candidates for Peacock shows.
It's definitely a head scratcher. I mean, keep in mind, obviously, he has the entire FBI franchise over on CBS. So he's.
But Universal is a co-producer of that, meaning that they still monetize that and split a licensing fee. You know what I mean?
Sure.
Like, they still profit from those shows airing on another network. They're not involved in these at all.
It is absolutely a head scratcher. So, and in cancellations, a little bit of sad news for people who care about such things. Netflix has canceled The Brother's Son after a single decently received season. It seemed like it was doing well, but once again, we have absolutely no clue what doing well means. And we return again to, yes, Netflix may have given us 6 months of data in one measurement, but I still continue to believe that we really and truly have no particular perspective on what success or failure means at Netflix in an actual, tangible, actionable way. So yay. Thanks though for the very large Excel doc.
I was really surprised by this one. I mean, especially because it came not that long after the show launched. It was in the Nielsen charts, I think, for 2 weeks. I mean, again, we have no real reason of knowing why. You know, they own this. It was produced under Brad Falchuk's overall deal with Netflix. Star-studded cast. Yeah, decent reviews. Yeah, I was surprised by this. And it was a Friday news dump too, which made it worse.
Perplexing and a little bit sad. You know, Michelle Yeoh has had two different one and done shows since she won her Oscar. She also had American Born Chinese on Disney Plus that was canceled after a season. And she was great in both American Born Chinese and in Brother's Son. And so that's too bad.
Up next.
Number two.
Hot off the heels of the Netflix Slam and the Netflix Cup, the streaming giant's next live sporting event will see Jake Paul enter the ring and face off against Mike Tyson in what it's calling a boxing mega event. This will be filmed July 20th, and it will stream live from AT&T Stadium in Dallas, home of the Dallas Cowboys, as well as featuring undercard fights. But in a larger sense, it's really the latest expansion into sports at Netflix. So, you know, while they don't want to bid and spend crazy money to try and get rights to MLB games or the NBA, et cetera, they continue to do what they are calling sports adjacent programming. So you've got a lot of docuseries, obviously the Netflix Slam, the Netflix Cup, all that stuff, but it's really just a push to get eyeballs on the streaming service and become, look, they've already got scripted, unscripted things that people have to see, although it's on their own schedule. This is basically saying, we're going to take the pay-per-view model and just throw it out. We're going to create our own events, and then you can watch it for free because you already subscribed to Netflix. There's no upcharge on top of it the way that like a Showtime or an HBO used to do for big title cards. Is that what it's called in boxing? Title cards? I know nothing about boxing other than it's gross. And Mike Tyson's a rapist. But yeah, go on.
And this is definitely sporting adjacent. Like Alex's story, he emphasized that it was unclear yet whether the headlining bout was going to be an officially sanctioned fight or an exhibition fight. And the truth is, I have a very difficult time imagining a legitimate boxing sanctioning body sanctioning a fight featuring a 58-year-old Mike Tyson. That to me seems crazy. I also should add that the longer we talk in this segment, the better my chances are of confusing Jake and Logan Paul at least once or twice. And I have to acknowledge, I understand that they are in fact completely different people. I don't necessarily know why they're completely different people. And I have to say that nobody in the history of the world's life has been improved by having the ability to distinguish between Jake Paul and Logan Paul. That being said,
the only thing I know about Logan Paul is that he lost a lot of money buying Pokemon cards. It's a random fact to know, but you know, look, if you're in the hobby, you know.
Well, but both, okay, so both Jake and Logan Paul have in recent years pushed into the boxing space. One of the two of them, that would be Logan Paul, the Pokemon investor, has mostly treated it as a joke. He's kind of treated his fights as stunty type things. You know, could he knock me out? Yes, of course he could, but he's not like making a life out of it. Jake Paul, to his absolute credit, has attempted to build a boxing resume composed of fights against people who are at least capable of fighting. He's had fights against a lot of MMA fighters who aren't technically boxers, but are still combat sports veterans. He's had his last couple fights against actual boxers, but kind of low-level boxers. He lost a fight against Tyson Fury's brother, so that was a thing. But like, he's tried to go to the steps of building up a career as a boxer. He's said that he wants to someday fight Canelo Alvarez, which would be ridiculous. He would killed, and that would not, well, I mean, probably that would sell well on pay-per-view, but it would still be gross and ghoulish. Some people have taken him to task for the slow buildup of his career, as if that's not what every single boxer does. You know, it's not as if boxers fight for titles within the first 5 or 10 fights of their career. Like, there are exceptions. Vasily Lomachenko. Let's get boxing nerdy here. Why not? Because I like boxing, even if you don't. He fought for a title in his third fight, but he did that having been a multi-time Olympic boxer and having one of the most storied amateur careers in fighting history. So it's not really the same thing. So, okay. So my point there is that the key difference between Jake and Logan Paul has been that Jake Paul has attempted to build up his career with increasingly legitimate boxing matches. This completely and totally undermines that. This is a stunt fight. This is nothing other than a stunt fight. Mike Tyson is, I believe he's going to be 58 at the time of this. That is creepy. And that's creepy even by the standards of a sport
Mike
in
Tyson.
Which...
Creepy by the standards even of Mike Tyson. I don't know. Does he have standards?
It's actually not creepy by the standards of Mike Tyson. It's creepy by the standards of a sport in which, you know, George Foreman became a champion late in life. Larry Holmes had multiple comebacks well into, for all I know, Larry Holmes could actually still be fighting as a professional. I'm not completely sure. But this is kind of undermining the legitimacy argument that he's been going for. And if this really is just an exhibition fight, that's downright silly. But having said that, there's no question whatsoever that both of the Paul brothers, regardless of whether they're actually different people or not, and again, I kind of illustrated how they were, they have large audiences. They have gigantic social media fan bases. And this all boils down to the fact that this will be successful for Netflix if it actually happens. I have no doubt whatsoever. Now, you could have a certain amount of skepticism as to whether it will happen. Like, will Mike Tyson be allowed into the ring? How will they be allowed into the ring? Will there be certain restrictions that have to be put on in terms of glove size and other various things like that? Because, you know, again, going back to whether or not Logan Paul could obliterate me in the ring, Mike Tyson could kill me in the ring, but he's still an AARP member who should probably not be in a healthy society having people watch him on television. But still, you put this on live Netflix, people will watch it. People have paid tens and dozens of dollars to watch the various different Jake Paul fights in recent months/years. And his last fight, he beat some tomato can boxer in less than a round. And people out there paid dozens of dollars for that. I didn't, but guess what? You put this on Netflix, I will absolutely watch it. So, and with X amount of shame, I will determine 6 months from now or 4 months from now how much shame I'm going to feel about watching this. But still, yeah, I will absolutely watch it.
Did you watch the Netflix Slam? Are you a tennis guy?
I'm somewhat a tennis guy, but no, I didn't watch it. I was aware, but I think I was only aware because our friend and colleague Chris Gardner was in Las Vegas for the promotional events around it. So he was social media-ing about the various different events and being in the same room as all of those various people. But no, I didn't watch it. The only Netflix live things that I've watched, I tuned in for 2 seconds of the fiasco involving Love is Blind just because I wanted to see everything breaking. So that made me laugh. I watched the Chris Rock comedy special because I had to for work. And I watched the SAG Awards 2 weeks ago, just in case anything interesting happened. And nothing interesting happened, I moved on with my life. That's the amount of Netflix live programming I've watched in the past.
You mean you didn't watch pro golfers play golf with Formula One drivers live on Netflix?
I did not. Was that actually what one of these things was?
That's the Netflix Cup, or that was the Netflix Cup. But yeah, the whole point of Netflix doing this, and it's really, again, like I said at the top of this segment, is they want sports programming. They have realized that it's an extremely lucrative and successful area for them. And if they get people watching live, there's a natural promo to get people to stay. So if you come for the Mike Tyson, Jake Paul stuff, I'm sure that they'll market something that's similarly themed to you during all of that. Either way, they're getting your foot in the door if you're already a subscriber. And if you're not and you have to watch this, it's probably a better deal to pay for Netflix because you get all of this content. You can cancel it immediately if you want or whatever, churn, whatever, but they're still getting your money. So it's probably cheaper than pay-per-view, and there's an additive thing to it, right? Subscribe to this service, watch this live thing, watch all these other things that they've got. So that's kind of the idea here. But, you know, the whole point is here too, is that Netflix continues to spend and spend and spend on sports and sports adjacent stuff. You know, we talked about this in January that the streamer spent north of $5 billion on a 10-year deal with WWE. We talked about the tennis matchup that they featured last weekend, and then obviously the Netflix Cup. And as our friend of the five, Alex Wepper, noted, Netflix continues to be a major player in the sports documentary space, with docs focusing on teams and stars in the NFL, Major League Baseball, the NBA, Formula One, NASCAR, PGA Tour, Pro Tennis, and others available or coming soon to the service, as he wrote this week. But yeah, this is more of where people are going to be spending money because it's not unscripted right now. Like I said, in summary, gets people in the door, new subscribers, makes people watch live. And if they, again, Netflix is trying to be the end all be all for everyone.
Up third.
Number three.
One of our themes this week could be changing strategies coming into focus. We've talked in the past about what Freeform used to be, what Freeform is right now, and what Freeform is eventually going to be. And with the current version being that Freeform just said goodbye to Good Trouble, and they're about to have the end of Grown-ish. But this week, things began to become a little bit more in focus in terms of what Freeform's future looked like somewhat. So break this down for us, Leslie.
Yeah, there's really not much to break down, but I will say it's a pretty savvy move. So Freeform announced this week that it will air two previously ordered Hulu unscripted series before both of those programs launch on the streamer as it doubles down on its non-scripted offerings. So what's coming to Freeform? DocuSoap Grand Cayman, Secrets in Paradise will debut on Freeform in April, followed by Wayne Brady, The Family Remix, coming in the summer. Both shows, like Freeform's scripted originals, Good Trouble, and the final installments of Grown-ish, will air the following day on Hulu. So it's interesting to me because they're taking a strategy that's been effective. Freeform knows that most of its content is viewed not on linear, but on streaming. Their target audience is young women. Young women do not have cable. They watch on streaming. So now they're taking these streaming shows and they're basically reverse engineering their model and saying, okay, well, we've got these Hulu shows that are coming, but you know what? It works toward our demo too. Probably costs next to nothing to give it a linear bow before it hits streaming. It's basically like a giant ad for Hulu here. So it's also a lot cheaper to do this than to make unscripted originals or even scripted originals. So we know that the Freeform's unscripted slate includes things like Chrissy and Dave Dine Out, as well as the upcoming Royal Rules of Ohio and whatever Sasha Reed and the Midnight Order is. So again, no scripted coming anytime soon. Execs have been mum on if they are planning anything on the scripted side, but it is a really kind of smart strategy because look, if there's a show that airs on Hulu or that's a Hulu original, but it makes sense for Freeform's audience and their demo, why not put it on linear first? Put it on linear second. It costs you nothing or pennies. Maybe you pay residuals to writers if it's scripted, right? Like, great. Writers get paid during an era where they're struggling. I mean, either way, what they have to figure out here is how to keep the lights on this network and how to do it in a way that's not going to cost them an arm and a leg. And this is it, or this is at least one way. At the same time, what's interesting to me is we know that now what's becoming of True TV, which is a network I don't think we've talked about very much at all. You know, I remember a couple of years ago, we would harass Turner executives or then Warner Media executives to try and get someone on our show to explain what the future of TNT, TBS, and True TV was. They declined for years. Anyway, they did a couple of interviews saying, oh, script is not going anywhere. Then Warner Brothers Discovery happens. Those execs who said that go out the window. Now it's Kathleen Finch's game to play with these three networks. And what do we know from True TV? Well, it used to be a comedy-themed network with a lot of scripted and unscripted programs. And now that's out the window too, as starting March 11th, the basic cable network is pivoting to primetime sports shows covering things like sports betting and the NBA, as well as simulcasts of live telecasts of various pro and college sports. And as part of the changeover, Impractical Jokers, the last remaining original series on the network, that's moving to the comedy-focused TBS in the summer. So True TV, now more like sports TV. TBS, more like, well, it's always been a comedy network, but now it's basically Impractical Jokers and a lot of like unscripted game shows. And TNT, which is a lot of acquired or low-cost foreign co-productions.
And the NBA.
And the NBA. There you go. I mean, look, it makes sense. You know, they own Bleacher Report, right? Why not lean into that kind of content?
And the timing makes sense also because this is the time of each year where I briefly remember where True TV is on my dial because they air a certain number of NCAA tournament games. And so that's a thing that I do every single year where I have no clue where or what True TV is. And then suddenly the one game that's coming down to the last minute in the first or second round of the NCAA tournament, that's on True TV. And it's like, oh God, I have to figure out how to find out where True TV is just in time to switch over. And about half the time I successfully do it. But yeah, this is absolutely the 2 weeks of the year where I know where True TV is on my dial, my proverbial dial. There are no such things as literal dials anymore. Kids out there listening to this podcast, back in the day, televisions didn't used to have remotes. They used to have dials and you used to turn them. I would add that phones also used to have dials and you would like spin them. You'd put your finger in a little hole and you'd go, wee.
That was called rotary.
Yes, it was called rotary. So anyway, this has been TV's Top 5 teaches you about history and in the process makes us all feel really, really old.
Thanks, Dan. Needed that.
My pleasure.
Up next.
Number 4.
Break out your Oscar ballots because Hollywood's biggest night of the year has arrived. The 96th Academy Awards will air Sunday, March 10th at 4 p.m. Pacific on ABC as Oppenheimer goes head-to-head with Barbie for Best Picture. Dan, we have not talked that much about the Oscars this year, so what do you think? Should we just do a quick little refresher on some of the key categories and things to know?
Sure, go for it.
Great. So Oppenheimer leads all nominees with 13, followed by Poor Things with 11, Killers of the Flower Moon with 10, and Barbie with 8. The Best Picture nominees are American Fiction, Anatomy of a Fall, The Holdovers, Killers of the Flower Moon, Maestro, Oppenheimer, Past Lives, Poor Things, Barbie, and The Zone of Interest. Your nominees for lead actor are Bradley Cooper, Colman Domingo, Paul Giamatti, Mr. In-N-Out himself, Cillian Murphy, and Jeffrey Wright. On the lead actress front, you've got Annette Bening going head-to-head with Lily Gladstone, Sandra Hüller, Carey Mulligan, and Emma Stone. Jimmy Kimmel returns as host of the ceremony, which will indeed feature Ryan Gosling performing I'm Just Ken from Barbie. So Dan, let's see. Of the movies that we just listed, I have seen The Holdovers and Barbie, and that's it. But what are you expecting from this ceremony here? I mean, and does the 4 o'clock start time kind of appeal more to you?
The 4 o'clock start time, I don't know that it makes necessarily that much difference. I guess more than anything, it means that for people on the East Coast, it isn't going to go as late. I don't know who it necessarily impacts. Also, they're very, very concerned about the combination of the 4 o'clock start time, which people aren't necessarily fully locked into. And then, as we mentioned earlier, the fact that this is spring forward weekend. So there's going to be a lot of time confusion. You should go and read Friend of the Five, Mikey O'Connell's interview with the producers of the Oscars, who talk about their concern about people knowing that the show starts at 4 o'clock and about how that's why they're doing interviews. So definitely that is a thing that they are doing. So you haven't seen the Oscar movies. You've also been skipping apparently the precursor awards, or else you would know these. Totally Cillian Murphy and not Cillian Murphy. I mean, geez. Anyway, nope. Cillian Murphy.
Cillian Murphy. Come on, yes. Dan. You know I have a history of mispronouncing everyone's name.
It's true. Anyway, though, it's all good. But one way or the other, yeah, it's going to be interesting to see how the ratings are impacted, because there's always the discussion of, is having successful films nominated for awards and destined to win awards, is that a thing that gooses ratings? And so you have Oppenheimer this year, and Oppenheimer, it's a lock, and it's as much of a lock as Everything Everywhere All at Once was last year. I don't know if it's going to end up with one or two more or one or two fewer wins than Everything Everywhere had last year, but it is as much of a sure thing. Oppenheimer is going to win Best Picture. Christopher Nolan is going to win Best Director. In all likelihood, Cillian Murphy is going to win Best Actor, but maybe not. Paul Giamatti could, but Robert Downey Jr. absolutely is winning Best Supporting Actor. It's probably going to win a bunch of technical stuff. I think that probably cinematography is in the bag, probably original scores in the bag. So anyway, that takes away though somewhat from the fact that Barbie isn't going to win all those awards. It'll probably win for one of the two songs, but otherwise, like, maybe Ryan Gosling would be the second most likely person to win if Robert Downey Jr. doesn't, but he's going to, so it's kind of moot. But there are a couple other fairly successful movies that are likely to win. The Spider-Man movie is almost certainly going to win the animated category. And again, these are all things that give little boosts. And so the show got a boost from the viral video with all of the different Barbie cameos and all of that. That was a nice little bump for the show. And again, if you read Mikey O'Connell's interview, you can hear the producer or see the producers, read the producers, whatever it is. It's an article discussing how they at least considered the idea that that filmed bit could have been the intro to the show, and they just decided not to. They decided to make it promotional, and that's probably logical. If you're a fan of seeing big movies win, then probably this is going to be your kind of year. If you're a fan of wide open races, probably this is not going to be your year. A lot of foregone conclusions. A couple of the categories that are still a little bit open. I think that probably about a month ago, Paul Giamatti looked like he was maybe inching into the lead in the Best Actor race, but I think probably that Cillian Murphy has moved ahead comfortably and that the momentum from Oppenheimer will boost him. I would bet on Cillian Murphy with Paul Giamatti is the second choice. The most open of the races is probably in the actress category, where it's going to be probably either Lily Goldstone or Emma Stone. It's all about the Stones this year. But yeah, and I don't think there's much chance that someone else, maybe Sandra Hüller, who had a very good year, Anatomy of a Fall and Zone of Interest. She's in both of those. Totally a breakout year. Maybe she sneaks in if the other two split the vote. I imagine that's going to happen. But just a lot of foregone conclusions. Like Davine Joy Randolph is going to win supporting actress. That's just a given. Lots and lots of categories like that.
Also, if you like Davine Joy Randolph, go back and watch High Fidelity on Hulu.
And then you can be angry along with the people who are still angry about that show getting canceled after one season. There's still a small group of people who are still frustrated.
Here.
Leslie is raising her hand. And then, you know, the show will be hosted by Jimmy Kimmel. And Jimmy Kimmel does a solid job with this. This is his fourth time hosting. He, of course, famously hosted in the envelope fiasco year and handled that probably as well as a human being could have handled it. And then he hosted the year after the slap, because the slap year was the year the three actresses' comics were the joint MCs, and it didn't go all that well. and not just because of the slap. It was fine. But anyway, Jimmy Kimmel does a decent job as host, and I think that's pretty likely and reliable. I think that Joe Coy with the Golden Globes reminded all of us that a host can still be really awful and can kind of sink an entire show around his performance, and that being a professional host will do good things. I think that the Emmys, which came right after the Golden Globes, taught us A, that having a respectable host like Anthony Anderson is a good thing, but they also reminded us that these are Hollywood honoring Hollywood shows, and that there's something to be said for actually liking the things that you're honoring. And so all of the things that worked best in Emmys were the tributes to TV shows past and to things that people actually liked. And I think you're going to see some of that with the Oscars. They're bringing back the former winners announce the nominees thing, which they did, I think, 15 years ago, and which was a really good idea and worked really well. And I understand completely why you couldn't get away with doing it every year. It would lose its magic, but 15 years has been enough. I think that is probably a good way to honor the industry. So yeah, I'm hopeful. And again, 4 o'clock, not 5 o'clock. And that also means 7 o'clock if you're on the East Coast. And, you know, like, seriously, adjust your time zones. You're all smart people. 4 p.m. Pacific, 7 p.m. Eastern, adjust accordingly.
So give us one long shot that you would like to see happen, Dan.
That I would like to see happen? I would love to see Zone of Interest win for sound. I'm going really marginal here. Not marginal. I'm going technical is what I'm going. The sound categories, as a rule, tend to go basically to the biggest, loudest, most action-y movie with the most explosions and the most gunfire. That's how it goes. I tend to be a fan of sound tapestry. So I continue to think that Roma, for example, was one of the best sound design movies I've ever seen. The sound design of Zone of Interest is where the Holocaust happens. The movie itself is designed as, here are these people living their banally evil lives in the foreground, while in the background, there's a genocide. And the power of it is keeping your ears open for the horrifying things that are happening in the background. And it is fascinating. It is a thing that can be studied well beyond just the studying of what you can see with your eyes in the movie. So if I had a weird and not random, but off the beaten path winner that I'd be rooting for, it would be Zone of Interest in the sound category.
There you go. Up next.
Number 5.
As usual, we wrap things up with the Critics Corner. Among this week's major new launches, Netflix debuts The Gentlemen, Apple has The Reluctant Traveler, Girls 5 Eva returns with its third season on Netflix after its move from Peacock, Extraordinary Season 2 debuts on Hulu, and Borders on Tubi. Dan, what do you got?
So this week I've spent a lot of time watching documentaries and programming for South by Southwest. So that has meant that I haven't been able to get to everything, and I've been concentrating on stuff like Three Body Problem. My review will be up roughly around the time this podcast is up. Actually, no, it'll be up tomorrow evening, Friday evening. So anyway, so there's been that and like 7 documentaries, some of which will be on different streaming services eventually and others will not. So some of the things I didn't get to and some things I only got to a little. For example, I watched 2 episodes of The Gentlemen, and then out of nowhere, for reasons I don't understand, my screeners vanished. I assume it was not a Netflix agenda kind of thing or a punishment kind of thing. I assume it was just a technical glitch, but it meant that I watched 2 episodes and stopped. And either the disappointing or the good thing is that I liked those 2 episodes. And the truth is, Guy Ritchie, this is based tangentially to the Guy Ritchie movie of the same name, some links, but none of the same cast, none of the same characters, for the most part, etc. Guy Ritchie has made some movies that I've really liked and other movies that I've really disliked. But what he does most consistently is movies where I kind of like the way they start and then I get tired of them. And so it would not at all surprise me if The Gentleman I got tired of, but I liked the first two episodes. I thought it set up an amusing world of kind of British tough guys threatening each other, which is, of course, what Guy Ritchie does. I think Theo James is a kind of dull leading man, but that's kind of what he's there for. And a lot of the cast is really great. Kaya Scodelario, I always like her. Daniel Ings is very funny. Jolie Richardson is great. Always love Giancarlo Esposito. Peter Serafinowicz is chillingly good. Vinnie Jones is good. Ray Winston is in the second episode. He's really good. There's a lot of violence and men being men and masculine and insulting each other. I liked the first two episodes. I can see so easily how I would get tired of this very, very quickly. And the first two episodes are fairly long. They're both over an hour apiece. I was entertained by them. And at some point, either when I get my screeners back or just when it comes out, I'll watch more and I'll watch until I get tired of it. Who knows when that will be. I also need to finish the second season of Extraordinary, but I watched the first six of the eight episodes, and it's really just a charmingly goofy British superhero show that popped up last year with no particular hype around it and proved to be one of the real charmers of the year. And the second season continues along with that. It got a very, very good cast. Mairead Tyers, Sophia Oxenham, and especially Luke Rollison are all fantastic. The premise, to remind people, is it's a world in which everybody has superpowers that sort of emerge when you hit puberty or your 18th birthday. Some of the superpowers are really cool and obvious, big, strong people being strong, people flying, etc. Others of them are very, very strange and quirky. But then the main character in the series is a 25-year-old woman with no superpowers. And she's trying to figure out how to either find her superpowers or to deal with life as an outcast by not having them. It's just a charming and funny show. And I like how well it works that in some episodes, there's almost no superhero stuff whatsoever. In other episodes, the superhero stuff is foregrounded and it's very funny. Sometimes it's kind of raunchy and uncouth in the guys kind of way. Yeah, I like the show and I really like the cast. The cast is just exceptional. And yeah, total praise for the cast, especially Luke Rollison, who I in an ideal world, it's the kind of performance that should get a comedy supporting actor nomination. Obviously, it would never happen because he's playing a shapeshifter named Jizzlord, which is not the sort of thing that you're ever likely to see announced as part of an Emmy nomination system.
And the Emmy nomination goes to Jizzlord.
Exactly. No, it's funny. Anyway, I really like Extraordinary. And again, the episodes are 30 minutes. They go by fast. I like it. And in a week where I'd had more time, I definitely would have finished watching it, but I'll finish watching it this weekend. And last but not least, Borders on Tubi. It's a boarding school, prep school, high school show. And it's very much in the vein of, if you like shows like Dear White People, Sex Education, basically any high school show, All American, you will probably find this fairly charming and likable because it's a decent version of the thing it's trying to be. It doesn't rewrite any of the rules of the genre. So if you are not a fan of high school college shows, this will not win you over. But if you are, it's very likable. The creator is Daniel Lawrence Taylor, who's mostly been an actor. This is his first time as a series creator. And it's smart. The premise is five kids from South London, all black kids, a couple of them from immigrant backgrounds, a couple of them not, are brought into a prestigious, mostly white prep school after the prep school has an assortment of embarrassing PR issues involving its privileged elite students. They need positive press, so diversity is where they go. And basically, they don't fit in. It's fish out of water stuff, but of course they fit in to some degree. The young cast, the five actors who play the five scholarship kids, they're all great. And the entire cast really is great. And that's one of the best things about this as a genre, is that you can watch a show like Sex Education or like Freaks and Geeks or like Dear White People, and you go, okay, these are people who are going to be populating TV shows and movies for the next 20 years. I think that Borders is that kind of show. And it's also a fun chance to get to use Tubi for something other than whatever random stuff is on Tubi that they stick commercials in at sometimes inappropriate places. So in this case, it's a TV show where they stick commercials in, but because of its British roots, probably most of those places will be appropriate. I don't know. Anyway, I liked it. It is not rewriting the rules at all. You will be able to predict just about everything that happens somewhat. I would say the show would have been better at 8 episodes or 10 episodes. A lot of the narrative is choppy, but I liked Borders. I like Extraordinary. And God help me, I liked the 2 episodes of The Gentleman that I watched. But if it turns out that it goes south in the 3rd episode, I take no responsibility whatsoever. I probably think you could blame Guy Ritchie for that.
Well, for more of Dan's weekly recommendations, be sure to subscribe to The Hollywood Reporter's Now See This newsletter and bookmark thr.com/TV-reviews for more. That feels like a good place to wrap things up. Thank you, as always, for listening to TV's Top 5, The Hollywood Reporter's TV podcast.
Subscribe to us on all of your various podcasting platforms. If you like us, rate us. If you really like us, write a little reviewy thing. They help spread the word of mouth. Come say hi to us on the social medias. She is, as always, at Snoodit, S-N-O-O-D-I-T. I am, as always, at The Fine Print, that's F-I-E-N. If you have questions for future mailbag segments, and we could certainly probably use a few of those in the next week or two, email us at tvstop5@thr.com. That is tvstop5@thr.com. Until next week, Leslie.
Until next week, Dan.